Welcome, 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 Wahoo Nation. Welcome to this week's edition of The Lockdown featuring T-Cub and the Ball Hawk. That's right. You heard Petty Hawk is back there. He out there at track practice today. So you ain't no telling what you going to hear. we've been waiting for part two with Thomas Q. Jones. What's good, fam?
What's up, brother? I'm here, man. Welcome. Thank you for having me, man. I love the last episode, part one. So now, man, we just got to finish it off with a good part two, man. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, man, what we'll do is just jump right in. Where we kind of left off was the initial entree into the league, first round draft pick by Arizona Cardinals. And we were talking a little bit through that first year. So we'll just pick it up. You know, what was that transition like for you going to Arizona? Being high expectations, a first round pick, a lot of teams feel like, hey, this guy's going to be the savior for us. How was it, you know, as you rolled into that?
Yeah, it was bittersweet. You know, to be drafted that high is always a dream for any football player that wants to make it to the NFL, to be in the top 10 picks and be able to go to a team in the NFL and then be that pick that high where, you know, you financially you will probably be in a good situation is great. The bitter part about that was I had to go all the way to Phoenix, you know, all the way from Virginia, you know what I'm saying, to Arizona, leaving my friends, leaving my family, leaving green grass and going to brown mountains, you know, it was different, you know, East Coast hip hop, wearing Tim's 24/7, 365 Tim's with shorts, Tim's with sweats, Tim's with jeans to it's 125 degrees. And now you got to put your Tim's up. It was a different experience. I was a little, you know, once I first got to Arizona, I was excited, obviously, about the football, but I really missed my friends at UVA and I really missed my family. And also, you know, one of the things about getting drafted that high is that you go to a team that didn't really have that good of a season. Mm-hmm. So I went to Arizona where they were coming off a pretty tough year. And yeah, they expect you to turn the whole organization around despite what their situation is. You're the top pick. They gave you money. You're highly touted. A lot of expectations. And unfortunately, when I first got to Arizona, I wasn't able to live up to those.
Understood. You were a little nicked up when you were there. So it was probably hard to get your footing. I mean, you know, like they say, you can't make the club in the tub. So, I mean, I'm sure that had frustrating for you as well.
Yeah. I'm used to the trainers, team trainers being the elite of the elite, you know, as a professional athlete, and even as a collegiate athlete at that level, you know, Division I football, you know, there's some talented people across the board, doctors, trainers, and then you learn to trust them. And I went to Arizona. I was hit at some point during the season, and gradually I realized that I started having shortness of breath. And I went to the trainers, and basically they sent me to a bunch of different people that couldn't figure out what was going on. And it gradually got worse, my breathing. And so it really, my rookie year, I kind of lost focus in football and started figuring out what was going on in my day-to-day life. You know, I couldn't really sleep. I was taking Ambien every night just to fall asleep because my breathing pattern was off. Every time I would take a deep breath, it would feel like there was a sharp pain in the middle of my chest. And I go to the trainers expecting them to tell me what was wrong and they can't figure it out. So I went through my whole rookie year, pretty much couldn't breathe. I randomly bumped into a chiropractor about 6 months after the season and in this regular gym that I went to. And at that point, I had honestly just given up. I was like, I don't know what's going on. I don't know what's going to happen to me. My mom, my family was all upset and they just, you know, we couldn't figure it out. I went everywhere. I had my lungs checked. I had my heart checked. I even had a biopsy on my stomach for acid reflux. I went everywhere. No one had the answer. I was addicted to, they even sent me to a psychologist thinking I had panic attacks. They gave me Paxil. They gave me Xanax. They give me all the wrong stuff. And luckily, I bumped into this random chiropractor at Lifetime Fitness in Northern Virginia. And he told me that I had three ribs that had come out of my sternum. And that was where the issue was. And they never thought once to send me to a chiropractor. So wow. I had three ribs out. And what happened was they had been out for so long that I developed a shallow breathing pattern, because every time I would take a deep breath in my diaphragm, it would hurt. So I stopped breathing deep. So I started breathing in my upper chest. So I couldn't get a full breath. So he actually put the three ribs back in, and I felt them slide back in the slot in the sockets. But they had been out for so long that they continued to come out. But at least mentally, I had some relief because I knew what it was now. After all those, you know, months of not knowing, I knew what it was. So I met a great chiropractor in Arizona that really, really helped me figure out how to maintain. And I went to him three times a week. And I started really focusing on my nutrition. I really started focusing on weight training. I wouldn't say it's a blessing in disguise, but it really made me really focus more on my body and realize that my body is my business in the NFL.
Facts.
And in college, you know, we could get away with stuff. You know, I lived at U Forum in Charlottesville. So, you know, the Hardee's is right there. 7-Eleven is right there. You go right up the stairs. So I'm at Hardee's. I'm at 7-Eleven, get slushies and Mike and Ike's. You know, you can get away with it. But yeah, when your job as a professional athlete is to, you know, be at 100% as much as you can, you have to recover. And so I had to really reassess where I was going in regards to just my body as a professional athlete. And the rib injury really made me focus on it. So that was a tough situation. That injury really, you know, held me back my rookie year. I went into my second year with a lot more confidence. I was in better shape. And I finally made it through that season injury free. And then my third season there, I started off great, leading the NFC in rushing after the first 2-3 weeks. And we played Seattle. And the last play of the game, I was tackled and I ended up getting a hairline fracture in my ankle. And that just bothered me the rest of the season. And that was my third year on a 4-year deal. And we realized it just wasn't working out. I wasn't really happy in Arizona. They weren't really happy with me. I had 1 year left on my deal. So we came to a crossroads.
Right.
Yeah.
So it was almost like, I mean, were you surprised at going to Chicago? Did you have any say-so in that?
Well, actually, I went to Rod Graves' house, who was the general manager at the time. Bob Ferguson was the general manager that drafted me. Bob was fired. My head coach, my head coach, Vince Tobin, was fired after the fourth game. So I didn't really have much stability there. Our general manager was fired after my first year, Bob Ferguson. So we had a new coach come in, and then I had a new offensive coordinator. Then I had a new general manager. And they all had their specific guys that they like, their draft picks. So I went through this shuffle, this NFL shuffle on one team. And I went to the general manager's house and basically told him, hey, listen, I have 1 year left on my deal. This just isn't working out. Unfortunately, you know, I don't really fit in with this team. It doesn't seem as if you guys support me. They had just brought in Emmitt Smith. They had signed Marcel Schick to a 4-year deal. I was almost, it was the writing was on the wall. And I really asked just for a trade or release so I could take my talent somewhere else potentially. And they basically told me no. They said, we can't just give you away. So literally what the general manager told me, Rod Graves, went to his house. And I was cool with Rod. So, you know, we had an open, candid conversation. He said, you know, if we can get something for you, we will. So I went the whole offseason. I didn't go to the offseason program whatsoever. I didn't even go back to the facility after my third year. And I get a call right before training camp in 2003 from my agent that says Tampa Bay, who just won the Super Bowl, wants to trade for you. So I couldn't believe it. I went from one of probably at the time the not so good franchises to one of the best franchises, just with one trade. And so I went to Tampa in 2003, totally different culture. I'm playing with guys there that I grew up watching. A couple of guys I played with in Arizona were there, Michael Pittman, Simeon Rice. These are all guys I played with in Arizona that had signed with them. And they won the Super Bowl the year before. But I'm playing with Dede, Rondé was there, Dwayne Stukes. So I have some familiar guys that in the locker room. So it felt more like home. It felt like football. Right. I was back on the East Coast. It wasn't as hot, you know, it was more humidity like it is in Virginia. So I got a chance to reset, hit the reset button. You know, John Gruden did me a solid, man. I'll always be thankful for John Gruden for trading for me, restarting my career.
Right, right. Yep. And so then after one injury-free season there, you know, rushed for, you know, about 6.5 and 4.6 yard average, then Chicago comes knocking.
Yeah, I started off as the number one prospect. This is how crazy the NFL is. I was the number one running back prospect going into the draft in the year 2000. After my rookie year, they said that I was the worst pick in the top 10 and a bust. So I was officially labeled a bust in after my 2000 season. So I went from being the number one running back prospect before the draft to after my rookie year being labeled the worst draft pick in the top 10 and a bust, to after my year in Tampa in 2003 to being the number one free agent running back available. So in a 4-year span, I went from the worst to the best to the best to the worst to the best again. And that's how I ended up going to Chicago, because Tampa, I wanted to re-sign with them, but they just didn't want to pay what I felt I deserved.
Right.
And I had a long conversation with John Gruden and Bill Meir, offensive line coach, even before the season was over. They wanted to re-sign me before the season was over. But I just felt like, you know, this is my opportunity to rejuvenate my career, and I need to get paid as a starter, because at that point I'd ended up being a starting running back in Tampa.
Right.
Over Mike Mustard, Michael Pittman, all the guys that I played with who were incredible backs. You know, somehow I found my way to the starting lineup. And I wanted to be paid what they were paid. They couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. So Chicago was next up.
Hey, TJ, was it ever any doubt that creeped into your mind? Because, you know, in the last episode, we talked about how successful you were in high school and the rushing records you had. And then coming to Virginia, the special year we had in 98, and then the records followed. You get to Arizona, they're not as successful. You were very durable high school, college, all those carries. I never really remember you having an injury or missing practice at UVA. Like, you always practice. So mentally, how was that for you as far as what were the phone calls like at home? Because I know you close with your sister and your brother. You know, Julius, a running back, a great running back in his own right. Did you ever lose that sense of, dang, do I not have it no more? Like, what was that like for you being out there?
Yeah, that's a great question, because then it becomes internal. It's like it's an internal competition with yourself, because you've been drafted, you know, you've been paid a good amount of money, you're financially in a good place. Now it's like, what do you want to do? Do you want to say, hey, you know what? I made it to the NFL. My dream came true. It didn't pan out, but at least I had the experience. Or do you say, I've been known as one of the best and at every level of football. This isn't about money. This isn't about a dream. This is about legacy. This is about my namesake. This is about how I can walk around for the rest of my life and people, how they see me. And to some people, that doesn't really matter. But to me, I have a lot of integrity and a lot of pride. And I completely put everything else to the side and said, this is my chance to overcome all these obstacles. That's the thing, man, when they say high risk, high reward. The NFL is the epitome of that. Mm-hmm. You get drafted. Once you get drafted, the honeymoon's over. Now the expectations start.
Right.
You know, people want you to come in and take them to the Super Bowl. That's it. That's the only answer. They don't care if you were injured. They don't care if you had a young offensive line. They don't care if you had a young defense. You couldn't get the ball back. They don't care about anything. They just know you're making more money than they're making. you're on the radar. You're fair game. And if you're not strong mentally, if you're not strong emotionally, if you don't have a strong background, a lot of people lose confidence in themselves and their ability. And then when your ego kicks in, you say, you know what? Well, at least I did this. At least I did that. And that never overcame me because I've always taken pride coming from where I come from in Virginia, the football tradition there, being part of the culture of Virginia, helping change the culture there. That's all I've known as a football player is to win and be the best. Mm-hmm. So I developed this really big chip on my shoulder when I left Arizona. And I played with that throughout the rest of my career because I never forgot that experience. I never forgot being called a bust. I never forgot walking in an Arizona Mills mall and you walk in a Foot Locker and the whole, all three racks are full of your jersey because no one's buying them. Mm-hmm. That motivated me. And I never forgot how I felt when I went through that.
Damn. Yeah, bro. Well, I tell you what, though, once you touch down in Chicago, it's obvious that shit was personal because, you know, that, yeah, the first year you put that foot in the ground in 2004, bro, you damn near rushed for 1,000 yards and 7 touchdowns. So it was clear that the shit was personal. And then you had, you know, after that season when Ron Turner took over as an OC and brought in the zone blocking scheme, bro. He was playing into your sweet spot, you know, and bro. To me, when I look back at it, bro, it took off from there because you never looked back at that from there, bro. So talk to us about, you know, you're like, all right, that first year, boom, you know, I rushed for 9.5, all right. New blocking scheme comes in and you go absolute ham, 1300 plus yards rushing, bruh. So, I mean, what was that transition like for you?
I mean, the transition for me was, this was a second chance. And also the legendary players that have played, I mean, this is arguably the most storied franchise in NFL history, in a major city that loves his football. I went from a city in Phoenix where football at the time wasn't the premier sport. You know, they loved the Suns and they loved the Diamondbacks. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a Cardinals town. They would, to be honest, we played at Arizona State Stadium. We didn't even have our own stadium at that time.
Right.
So
right.
We're playing, it's 120 degrees. I mean, some of the games they would black out the games in Phoenix in that area because they wanted you to come to the game. So you didn't come to the game, you couldn't see it. Mm-hmm. That's how few fans we had at the games. We would have more away fans at our home games than we would at home fans. I felt more hype when I would play in an away game. I felt more like I was in the NFL when we would play at Green Bay and we would play at Philly or we would play at Dallas. Versus home, because we were playing in a college stadium and the fans just didn't show up because it was too hot and we weren't really that good. So, mm-hmm. But Chicago was a complete 180. This is Chicago, Chicago Bears, the Bears, Walter Payton, Neil Anderson, Jim McMahon, the Super Bowl shuffle. I mean, it was like, wow, this is a team that I grew up watching. Mm-hmm. And so there was just a lot of mystique in Chicago. And I felt like I was in the perfect position to fill a void that they had there, but also make a name for myself in one of these cities that's known for football. So my first year there, 04, I was just hell bent on getting 1,000 yards. And mm-hmm. I said, at that point, I have to go to a Pro Bowl. Because also when I came to the NFL, I didn't have a plan. My plan was to get to the NFL. And I think a lot of people don't realize that. My plan was to get to the NFL, not what am I gonna do in the NFL. So I had to restructure my priorities as a football player on the go.
Right.
Some guys say, I want to go to the Super Bowl, win the Super Bowl. I was like, I just need to get my mom out of coal mines.
Right.
So I got drafted, mission accomplished. And all of a sudden you're like, oh shit, now I have to play. You know, so I had to really reassess my goals and what I wanted to do. And Chicago was the best place to do it my first year. We struggled a little bit, 5-11. I had a hyperextended toe. I missed two and a half games and still almost rushed for 1,000 yards, which was huge for me. And then, but you got to understand, I'm still labeled as a bust. So no matter what, no matter if I have 150 yards at Green Bay, the lead in is Thomas Jones, a bust with the Cardinals. I mean, it was just a tag. Right. It just it was like the scarlet letter. And my mind, I was like, I'm not a bust. I know the situation I was in, but I know that the only way I can get that stain off of me and clean it up is I have to perform. And so I performed my first year. My second year, they ended up drafting Cedric Benson, rest in peace. And that was really, I think, the moment that my career really shifted. Mm-hmm. Because when Cedric came in, it just created a whole other situation around me as a running back. Because I felt like I finally got into a place where I was accepted, I was successful, I fit in with the team, I fit in with the city. But now here comes another obstacle. And so that chip on my shoulder just got bigger. Mm-hmm. And that's what pushed me throughout the rest of my career, was them drafting Cedric Benson, because it was almost like enough is enough. And it wasn't personal to Cedric whatsoever. It was more so about, you know, people doubting me and my ability, and I was fed up with it. And so I channeled all that energy into watching film in the weight room, being relentless in practice, finishing every single run, being violent, being physical on the field, creating a presence for myself, creating a reputation for myself. And I never shied away from it.
Damn.
Now, I agree with that. I mean, cut you off, Cove, just to echo that you never shy away from stuff, because you could look at when you were here at UVA, when Womack came in, and you're a guy that I consider, like, you don't have that hater raid in you. Like, no, you embrace the competition. You want to make sure that your competition is at its peak, so you could perform at your peak. And I think that's just a testament to just who you are and where you came from, that you're not afraid of hard work. You're not afraid of competition, because as you said, when Cedric came in, you embraced that and you embraced him. And you took off and you embraced the bus talk, even though it's tough for you mentally. You channel it in a positive way, man. So I think that speaks volume to your character.
Thank you, man. It's hard, you know, when people are looking at you, because everybody wants to be successful and be respected for their job. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that's not the case all the time. But like you said, when Antoine came in to Virginia, it wasn't personal, but I know he was highly recruited. I know that there was some talk about him potentially being a starter over me my sophomore year. And it went back to where I come from. It went back to my mom, my dad, the hard work that they put in and sacrifice for us, and the namesake, the last name. I'm playing for the last name. Everything else will come with that. So what do I look like not fighting and competing until I fall out for my namesake and my legacy? And I've never, like you said, have not one hater bone in my body. There's enough to go around for everybody. And that's what I loved about me and Antoine Womack at Virginia, is we both were literally the same person. We respected each other so much, had so much love for each other. And we took on the role of being the best running back combination in the country, not the best running back, because, you know, you always get more highlights when there's more people. The more people are successful, the more comes for everybody. Right. So we were coming in and out of the game, and like, I'm number six. I get a 10-yard run. Will come in. He get a 15-yard run. We were 6 and 8. We both had ball heads. Like, it was like just this. It was gangster. Like, you know, we just,
I got a ball head.
Yo, you couldn't stop us, man. Like, we were just we were unstoppable. And then obviously my senior year, Antoine wasn't in school, and then that just kind of opened the doors for me to be able to get the carries that he would have gotten. It just worked out that way, but that's not something I would have wished on anybody. We had a great relationship. And thing in Chicago with Cedric, I tried to embrace him in that same way, but it was a little different for Cedric, because Cedric had always been the man in Texas and in high school. I mean, he's a huge recruit in high school. He was a Dope Walker Award winner in college, you know, had all these records. But what he didn't realize is that I was used 6 years ago, 7 years ago.
Right.
He didn't realize that, because when you have a bust label, or when, you know, they draft you, then in your mind you think, well, they must have drafted me this high than before, because this guy doesn't have the talent, or, you know, I don't blame him. I blame Lovie Smith, and I blame Jerry Angelo, the general manager, for not prepping him for what he was coming into. Because at the time I was a team leader. I was a huge part of the team, and my offense was my offense, literally. But they didn't prep him enough, so he didn't come in with that understanding. And initially, I tried to work things out with him and like embrace him like I did Antoine, but that wasn't his mindset, and so we clashed. But in us clashing, it just pushed me to the maximum in regards to like not being able to let up at all, because he was a great back too. And at any moment, one injury, one fumble, the opportunity, the door's open. And I couldn't let that happen. But it made us both better overall. Yeah. You know, and the second year there, we ended up going 11-5. I rushed for 1,300 yards, and we go to the playoffs. And that was another thing. I won a state championship 2 years in a row in high school, won 27 straight games between my junior and senior year. In college, we didn't go to the national championship, but you know, we were up for the ACC title in 98. And we went to a bowl game pretty much every year. There was just a level of excellence that was expected. And I hadn't been to a playoff game. So I'm like, I gotta taste this playoff. Like, I need to see what this playoffs feels like in Chicago. And so we were able to go to the playoffs. We lost the first game. Well, the divisional game, we had a bye week. We lost to Carolina. And that put a bigger chip on my shoulder, because now I'm like, I've tasted this. Now I need to go, what's the Super Bowl taste like? Mm-hmm. And then in 2006, rushed for 1,200 yards, 13-3, and we get to the Super Bowl. I mean, incredible experience.
With Rex Grossman as your quarterback. Rex Grossman was his quarterback.
Hey, that's all you got to say. You got to the Super Bowl.
It's not, Rex, Rex. It's not a shot at Rex. It's just, yeah, it's just a perception, at, you know, all the highlights and the spotlight that they put on the quarterback position. But I always tell people, it's the ultimate team sport. Like, quarterback is the position they elevate, that they pay, that get all the money. But he went, it was 13-3. Rex Grossman was a signal caller. And when you look at that team, people don't realize Thomas was the starting running back.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, when you're, it's, now that I'm far removed from the game, you can look at it from a more, honest perspective, because you're not as close. You know, you have respect for your teammates, but, you know, a spade is a spade. And yep. My first year there, we went through five quarterbacks, five.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I was still almost rushed for 1,000 yards, because when you have five quarterbacks, the defense knows you can't throw.
Yeah.
They're like, yo, listen, we're going to put 8-9 in the box. We're going to play man coverage. And we're going to make you beat us with the run. So that means that there's somebody you either have to make miss, run over, or something to be able to get 900 yards. Same thing in the next year. You know, Rex Grossman goes down in the preseason. And Kyle Orton comes in, and he says he's a rookie quarterback. It's never played. The defense, the coaches, they know we're not going to, a rookie quarterback's not going to come in and beat us. So we got to run the ball. So that's the year you go for 1,300. Then the next year, Rex comes back and he's healthy the majority of the year. And Rex was a streaky quarterback. He would have a game where he might have five touchdowns, and then the next game he has five interceptions. But the defense knew that. But at the end of the day, we knew the running game had to be solid. So between linemen and the running back group, our fullback, Jason McKee, me, said Adrian Peterson, we knew we had to carry the game. We carried us to the Super Bowl in regards to just the consistency. Unfortunately, you know, we didn't win, which is still devastating to this day. And it always will be. But the fact that I had a chance to turn my career around in that three-year span was... that was the real dream. Getting drafted was the great opportunity, but the dream was being recognized and respected in the city of Chicago in the long, in the long line of great running backs that they've had there, Gale Sayers and you know, Walter Payton, to be thrown in that mix and respected, that's priceless.
How is it as an offensive guy to be a teammate of one of the most explosive returners in NFL history, and Devin Hester?
That was crazy because we didn't see it coming. I knew, you know, once you're in the league and you're so focused on your own career and winning and all of your personal situations in regards to your contract, and am I going to be here, and am I going to get a new contract? Am I going to need to get playing time? Or am I splitting? You don't even really focus on people who are coming in. Even Cedric, when Cedric came in, I didn't know much about him. I heard of his name, but I'm not watching him. I'm watching other running backs. Who's the top backs in the league? I'm watching LaDainian Thomas. I'm watching Tiki Barber. I'm watching Fred Taylor. I'm watching these guys because I'm watching film. I'm watching Ray Lewis. I'm watching Michael Strahan. I'm watching Brian Dawkins. I'm watching these guys. These guys I'm competing against. So once you get to the NFL, if you're coming from college, you're still coming from college. I know the difference because I came from college. So I wasn't really paying much attention. Same thing with Devin. Devin just out of nowhere, it's almost like he would have been playing for 20 years. He just was comfortable. I remember his first game, I think we played at Green Bay, and he returned a punt return. And I don't think we thought anything about it. I didn't realize that he was that good in college until after I retired. And I would start seeing people post his college stuff on Twitter. And then I made me go back and look on YouTube, and I'm like, I know obviously he was great in the NFL, but I didn't know that he was that good in college because I was so disconnected from college football. Devin Hester, man, I mean, first ballot Hall of Famer. At any moment, this guy, I mean, I've seen him do some stuff in games, and I'm talking about cold games where, like, we played Minnesota and Chicago one year, and this punt return he had, he got hit about four times, bounced off of everybody. And I look over to the other opposite sidelines, and he's gone. And I'm like,
that's a home game, too.
Home game. The kickoff return he had after in New York, we played the Giants in 2005, 2006. Then they kicked the field goal, and it was short. And he, you know, did kind of a walk-off, like he was about to touch back, and he, boom. And that was a design play. Took it back, I think it was 100 and whatever yards, I don't know. Dude, at any moment, was just a ticking time bomb. Incredible experience playing with him.
Mm. That's awesome. So you know, going back to the NFC Championship game where you rushed for 123 yards, leading them to the Super Bowl, making key play to make that happen in that game. And then playing in the Super Bowl, rushing for 112 yards, and you got, you know, the Bears only calling 15 running plays that game. And you was on one that day. And imagine, do you think the result could have been a little bit different if they'd have actually fed the monster?
Man, listen, I for a long time after that Super Bowl, I would always question why. Mm-hmm. I remember I had a 51-yard run. And the thing about the Colts is they were super fast with Robert Mathis and Dwight Freeney, but they were small.
Yeah.
And our offensive line, I was so in tune with our offensive line. We were like brothers. Every Thursday we go, they had offensive lineman dinner, I was there. Wherever the linemen were, I was there. I would work out with them in the weight room, warm-ups, we're all together, we're on the bus. I'm with the linemen. John St. Clair, you know, my best friend, he was with Chicago. He played tackle. And so I'm always with the linemen all the time. And we knew if we could just line up and just push them back, they couldn't stop us. And I had a 51-yard run. I had watched so much film on them. I knew which way Dwight was going to spin. I knew which way Robert Mathis was going to spin. And I remember after the 51-yard run, I came to the sidelines. And I told my running backs coach, Coach Spencer, Tim Spencer, I said, Spence, don't take me out. Don't take me out. Because me and Cedric had a rotation, two series rotation. And that was my second series. I said, don't take me out. Don't take me out. I got 250. Run inside zone. Just run inside zone to the right and to the left. Just run it all the way down the field. And he looked at me nod his head. And I'm like, don't take me out. Run inside zone, this time to the right. We just ran it to the left and I broke 51 yards. Run it to the right. And when we came back from TV timeout, I had my helmet on and Spence looked at me and said, Sid's going. And I knew at that moment there was probably something else going on outside of just winning the game. Yeah. Because you can have a two-person rotation that makes sense. But when you get into the Super Bowl, if it would have been Cedric that had that 51-yard run, me, I would know he's in a zone. So right. If they didn't put me in that next series, they let him go because he was hot. I got to respect that.
True.
I got to, it's the Super Bowl. Listen. I got to respect that because if this man go for 300 yards, we win. I'm a Super Bowl champion.
Right.
And they put Sed in, and then I think he ended up having a fumble. And then he ended up getting hurt, which hurt us too, because, you know, we needed Sed in that game and he ended up getting hurt. And I think from that point forward, I think it was just, they really just lost track of the game plan and got away from it. Because if you have 15 carries for 112 yards, that's 7.5 yards a carry.
Yes, sir.
And if someone's averaging 7 yards a carry in the NFL in the Super Bowl game, it is mind-boggling why you didn't get more carries. But I blame Lovey. I blame Jerry Angelo. I think that they had an agenda in regards to me because they drafted Cedric and they needed to make sure that Cedric had every opportunity to shine, especially in the Super Bowl. And that hurt us. And it wasn't Sed's fault. It was literally Lovey and Jerry Angelo's fault from the beginning. So I put Ron Turner, you know, as an offensive coordinator. You know, you put Rex in a situation where it's raining, clearly he's struggling. The game was too big for Rex. It was too big for him. And this is just being honest. Like I said, I'm disconnected now. I can look at it. I can pull a game up and I can see. You know, I'm like, Rex, just dump it to me. They're playing man coverage. They're backing up. It's raining. Dump it to me. I want a check down. Dump it to me. Make them come up and make them come up.
Right.
And he wouldn't run. He would not run. He would not scramble. I'm like, Rex, one time I came to the sidelines and I was like, Rex, just run. Just run, man. They're dropping back in coverage. Just run. It was just the game was too big for him.
Yeah.
It's too big for him. So
My running back got averaging 7.5 yards a game. He touching it no less than 30 times. You know, that I'm just saying that's where I come from.
That's what I would assume, but you know, once you have an agenda and you have something in your mind, it's kind of hard to change horses in midstream.
True.
And they just couldn't adjust. They couldn't adjust. So unfortunately we didn't get a chance to win, but I mean, it's an experience that no one can take away. It's devastating to be a Super Bowl loser because that's what you are. People in the NFL and at that level of professional sport, it's about the winners.
Right.
But it's an incredible experience and I wouldn't change anything in regards to how I got there.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, it's amazing, man. You know, I know we talked about how Chicago was kind of feeling like the start of the underdog tour, because that's really what that was, man. And, you know, you having an underdog mentality and when I say underdog mentality, that's one that, you know, somebody that possesses a perseverance to overcome any obstacle, you know, refusing to be out of work while understanding the difference between competing and just working hard, you know, the relentless pursuit of greatness. To me, that's the underdog mentality, and that's what you had. You know what I'm saying? And so that's a shining example. And you know, I mean, we all people like, how in the hell was Thomas an underdog? People don't understand. You can have it. You can have, I was the greatest in high school. I was the greatest in college. I was a first round draft pick. And you still become an underdog because we all got shit we go through And people right. don't understand. Sometimes we go to that place and some people never make it out.
Right.
You know, they right. don't have that mental toughness or that mentality to be like, yeah, this is not where the story's going in. You know what right. I'm saying? So for you, right. it was like touchdown in Chi-Town and it was boom, boom, boom. You leave Chi-Town and it was New York Jets, 1,000, 1,300, 1,400. You know, move on to Kansas City, 896, 478, you know, and all the touchdowns that came along with that, you know, leading up to 10,591 touchdowns. I mean, rushing yards and 71 touchdowns, bro, over a career, you know? And so it's like, when you look back, you know, people be like, damn, I had no idea that he right. was going through that. And I, you know, I get it. And it makes, as a fan, you look at it and be like, damn, I really fucks with him now. Cause I had no idea that, you know, I just see, hey, Thomas Jones, and he was great. And they don't know the valleys, bro. They just right. see the mountains. They don't know what the valleys right. are like. You know what I mean?
Right, right, right. And that's in life in general, everybody.
Facts.
You know, whether it's football, whether it's, you know, where you come from.
Yeah,
there's overcoming jobs and maybe you lost your job and, you know, the pandemic hits and like you have
yes,
to,
sir.
I mean, that's the same thing. It's that underdog mentality, but the relentless pursuit of greatness. And a lot of that comes from where I came from. I mean, I had 3,319 yards rushing my junior year. And I remember getting a Super Prep magazine. Back in the day, they had this magazine, high school magazine, a recruiting magazine called Super Prep. And it was a really respected magazine. And they had a lot of the All-Americans and top recruits in each state at each position. And going into my senior year, after my junior year, rushed for 3,000 yards, they had me rated this number 7 running back in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And in my write-up, they said Thomas Jones. First of all, they had my name wrong. They had Tom Jones, first of all. They said this kid had 3,319 yards rushing, but he's in the middle of nowhere. Competition is a question mark.
Mm.
And I know the kind of football we play on our end. It's small school football, single leg, but we play smash mouth football. We don't have the athletes that you guys have maybe in Carolina on you, or definitely on the 757 side. We didn't have any Ron Currys or Michael Vicks or Ma Hawkins or Antoine Womack. We didn't have any of those, but we play smash mouth football. You were not going to run. You were going to get hit, period. Right. No matter how fast you were, you still going to get hit. That's just how we play smash mouth football on the side of a mountain. So I didn't know finesse football. I didn't know. I never played that way. So when I got to Virginia, I started seeing a lot of guys that were like finesse players, like finesse kids. I never was around any, unless we played the state championship, but we played Sussex Central, we played Northampton, and we beat them like 33-6. Like they, I guess, would think that they would beat us because of, you know, where we from. But once we lined up, we just hit people in the mouth. Like that's all I knew. And I think because of constantly being questioned in regards to where I'm from, questioning who I played against, that always made me feel like the underdog, no matter how successful I was.
Right.
Also, you got to understand my name. I have a very, very simple name. So I might rush for 1,700 yards, but LaDainian Tomlinson has a different ring to it than Thomas Jones. You know what I'm saying? So there's a lot of factors that I had to think, because I'm like, damn, like, I feel like I'm not even getting respect. Like, but there's a lot of different factors. And when they look at my overall career, the first thing a lot of people think about is the Jets or the Bears.
Yeah.
But because I came in known as a bust, it's not the same as it would be with an Adrian Peterson who comes in rookie of the year, or Edgerrin James, because they came out on fire. Mm-hmm. Me, I came out and just was, you know, lost in the shuffle. And then I emerged
right
from the back end.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
So yeah, it's cream rise to the top.
Yeah, it was a pretty interesting journey for me, you know, pretty interesting journey. And when you look back on the numbers, A lot of people don't know. More, a lot of people are like, wow, he had that many yards. Like,
yeah,
right. Because they don't, they weren't paying attention.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the real was
I shared a lot.
Yeah.
I shared a lot. And people always give me that, like, really, TJ ran for 10K? I'm like, yeah, dog.
Yeah.
Here you go.
Yeah, indeed. Well, you know, look, they just don't, you know, nominate anybody for the Pro Football Hall of Fame. So, I mean, I'm just saying. So to be nominated in the class of 2020, look at here, man. Brad.
Yeah. Brad. It was definitely, I can honestly say I didn't expect to go from being labeled a bust to being Pro Football Hall of Fame nominee.
Right.
I didn't expect it, but with the way that I worked, I will say I'm not surprised. Because it's about the work, man, the work and the dedication. Yeah. And also the example that you can be for other players, other guys that come in the league to start off not so high, to start off in a team that they don't fit in. You know, I want to be an example for those guys. Listen, man, you have the talent. All you got to do is keep working and believing in yourself. And eventually tables will turn. That's a lesson for life, period, true, whether it's football or anything else. That's true, a lesson for life or anything else, man. So,
so that's it sounds like that's the same type of mentality you took into post NFL becoming an actor, because that was something different. You know, you were used to the sports part of it, you know, because it came natural to you. So then to flow into being an actor and being a Hollywood dude and then but doing it well, you know, how has that been for you? What was the mentality like going into it? I know Clifton Powell was a mentor for you from the beginning.
Yeah,
you know, shout out to as they say from Minister Society. What they call it?
We're gonna say bust the ass Chauncey.
Okay, we're gonna say bust that. Yeah, all right, so we had T Dub edit that out then. All right, bust the ass Chauncey. But yeah, so what was that like, fam?
That was crazy. I wasn't expecting that whatsoever. I was like bored, man. I was done with football. Didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was always interested in the entertainment industry. I had a music label, I had an artist that I was working with, I had a deal with Universal. I would be in a studio with my artist, you know, producing and writing music and all that. But I wasn't the actual talent. I was like managing and producing, which is different than being the talent.
Right.
And I ended up working on this project with Cliff and Michael Blackson in Miami in 2012. And I played his nephew, and I really was like, this is interesting. I never thought about acting. But I ended up liking it, and he really encouraged me because he said I had some natural ability. And he pushed me. He really pushed me because he would call me and say, hey, did you get any acting classes? I'm like, no, not yet. Boy, you better get some acting class. You better get an acting class. And so I actually took him up on it. I said, okay, you know what? Let me go to New York, find an agent, and see what happens. So I found a really good agent named Ben Oduro, who to this day, I think I'm so grateful for that man, because if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be acting. He would send me on auditions, I wouldn't go. He sent me on an audition in LA, I might fly out there that day, didn't look at the lines, go in, just do the audition just because I didn't want him to say I'm not going to the auditions and fly right back the same night. That's how much I just wasn't passionate about it. But I ended up going on an audition for Being Mary Jane, show on BET with Gabrielle Union, and I booked the role. And I shot 3 episodes, and it was a crash course. I didn't realize how big the show was because I didn't really watch much TV. Mm-hmm. And I got on set, and Regina King was directing my first episode. And then Rob Hardy directed the other 2 episodes I did. And there was just so much lingo that I didn't understand. I hadn't been in any classes. Luckily, I was able to play a character that I could connect to in real life. And I didn't have to really be technical as an actor. I just had to just kind of be myself, and it worked out. But once I left set after filming for like 3-4 weeks, I was like, whoa, I don't know what any of this lingo means. I literally just kind of like bullshitted my way through this whole thing. And it scared me straight to the point where I'm like, yo, I need to really get in some classes if I'm gonna do this right, because I can't go on set and be, you know, faking the funk. I'm doing more acting off camera than I am on camera. You know, oh, you know, I need you to do this. That's a little on the nose. You know what on the nose means, right? Yeah. You walk with
me. I got you.
I don't know any of this stuff. And you can't say you don't know. because you want to show me, you know, you want to, it's a big show. There's actors that went to Juilliard, the performing arts school, that auditioned for this role that didn't get it. I got it. So it's almost disrespectful to the craft to like, just, well, I don't know. I just so happened to book the role. You know what I mean?
I was winging it.
Right. Yeah. You can't do that. You know, so I moved to LA, got in an actor studio, and Franz Turner was my acting coach. I mean, really shaped and molded me into a real actor. He created an opportunity for me to release a lot of demons that I had from football and from my upbringing that I didn't have a chance to, and football didn't allow me the chance to. It allowed me the chance to, but more in a physical, violent way because of the nature of the game, where he allowed me to deal with those things and put all that energy and passion and vulnerability into the characters. Right. So once I learned how to transition all that into the characters, then it became like second nature and it became therapeutic. Right. So now every character I'm using something in my life that I either didn't want to deal with, that I pushed to the side, or that I felt a way about. And I was able to release all of that into the characters and make the character come to life. Straight Outta Compton, I booked a quick little small scene in that movie. And it was three lines. But what I was thinking about in those three lines came across on screen. Because it was a relationship that I had with somebody that I couldn't do what I wanted to do based off of how they made me feel. So I put all of that into this guy.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Wow.
So can a take a little deeper dive. who you was waterboarding right there?
Let's just say it's somebody that I wouldn't have expected to have this energy with, and that's what made it more honest for me.
Gotcha.
Okay.
But without the training. Without actually buying in and committing, I mean, I wouldn't have known how to use that technique. And I think sometimes when you have the smallest amount of lines is where you have to really believe it the most. Because you only have three opportunities to make your presence felt. You have three lines.
Right.
So now it's, what are you thinking? Who is this person to you? What did they do to you? What are the stakes? What happens if you don't get your point across? As everything is life or death. If I don't get my point across to this person, he could kill me. That's with every scene, regardless of whether or not it's about anything that's you know, life or death. It's even if a love interest scene with someone and you're fighting for your relationship, it's life or death. If I don't get this woman, I'm literally going to die. I have 5 minutes to get this woman to believe me, or I'm gonna die. And that's what you think. And so you when you're going towards your objective, your motivation is so, you believe it, you're honest, because you have to convince this person of what your objective is. Like in Straight Outta Compton, my objective was to get him to fear me. You know what I'm saying?
To get him to fear you me. When I watch you. I feared you, I didn't know who you was. Yeah. It worked. I mean, cut you off, my bad.
And there's different ways you can do that. You know, you don't have to, you know, there's typical ways that people would expect, but it's always good when you can go the opposite route. Mm-hmm. You know, most of the most scary people are the quiet ones. Usually the ones that's rah, 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 you know, it's kind of like they do that all the time. More than likely, they're doing that as a defense mechanism, hoping you don't do something. But the quiet ones are the ones that are controlled, cool, calm, collected. They've probably done this before.
Right.
They're comfortable in that space. So that's why you're a little more nervous. And that's how I played that character. And then all the other characters I've played since then, Luke Cage, Comanche, all these other characters that I've been able to play, I've been able to use all of that training. I was in acting classes, two different acting studios for 4 years, 6 hours a week. Because I had to play catch up, because I'm on camera with Alfre Woodard, who's been doing this for 40 years.
Right.
Giamatti, 40 years. Theo Rossi, 20 years. I mean, Gabrielle Union, 20-something years, 30 years in the business. these people, I was playing football where they were in performing arts school and on set.
True.
So like you said, the underdog, because they also see you as an athlete, as a football player. They don't see you as an actor. That's why I added my middle initial to my actor, to my name. So we separate Thomas Jones, Thomas Q. Jones.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
I put a lot of thought into
it. I asked you about that, man.
Yeah. What was your favorite role that you that you've been in?
My favorite role probably, man, in my probably in my film A Violent Man that I produced and starred in.
That was a dope movie, bro.
Okay.
Appreciate it, man. Thank you, man.
Good business.
Yeah, that was, and also I had a chance to work with Kalila. She repping the 757, Kalila Joy.
Yeah, repping the five.
Yeah, Kalila went to UVA with us, and she was your class, am I right? She was in your class.
Yes, she was incredible, my class, absolutely.
Incredible actress, you know, specifically picked her to play my love interest because we already had chemistry from, you know, knowing each other since 1997. And then she's just a really talented actress. I had a huge part in the script. The pre-production, the casting, the post-production, even getting it sold to a distribution company. I had my hands in all of that. So I got a crash course in producing. And then I'm the lead, so I have to carry the movie. And it wasn't a typical movie. It was so many elements to it. It's a suspense film with the MMA backdrop. So I had to train for MMA for 2 months. Train with Chuck Liddell for 2 weeks straight, doing fight choreography.
Wow.
It was a huge, huge process. But what it did was it got me ready for any and all types of projects. There's nothing that I shy away from in regards to characters. Even accents, I mean, P Valley, that was another really cool role.
Yeah, it was, pal.
You know, we had to have an accent and really makes you a student of the craft because I'm not from Memphis. I mean, Virginia, we have a specific accent, but that's a very specific accent. So I studied K. Michelle, I studied Yo Gotti, I studied even Lil Boosie. I'm listening to these people in my headphones as I'm walking around, and then I'm talking to everybody. So anybody I talk to, I'm talking like Maine.
Right.
Okay.
I'm not talking to my regular voice. So people that don't know me, they think I talk like that because that's how I'm talking. I'm talking like that all day long. Hey, man, you know what I'm saying? Man, you know,
with that draw.
Yeah, you talk like that because then you get comfortable. Because once you get comfortable with the accent, then you get comfortable with the performance.
Right.
So now you're not in your head thinking, do I sound stupid? Like, do people believe me? Like, you get comfortable because it's practice, hard, same thing. So football really gave me an advantage coming into this because the hard work that I was used to in football and the specificity and the attention to detail, I just brought that over here.
Right.
So.
Right.
Yeah.
So do you prefer television or film?
I prefer film.
Okay. Because you can put more depth into it.
Yeah, film is like very boom, boom, gun, cut. Two, three takes, cut. Because it's because of time, the 12-hour day. You still have the same thing in film, but with film, you could be a lot more liberal and open.
Right.
As opposed to TV, where TV is very specific to that audience, for that network. Where... Like A Violent Man, it was raw, it was honest, it was, you could just really embrace the character and be shameless in regards to how you portray it versus TV where you got sponsors, you got, you know, that are sponsoring the show. So you gotta, you know, be a specific way. You have to pull back the reins and be less passionate. It's you know, but either, it also depends on the character. Like my show that I'm gonna just promote now, Johnson.
Yeah. Go ahead. Talk about that.
Yeah, the show Johnson. So my producer partner, Deji LeRae, shout out to Deji, created the show in 2014. And when I moved to LA in 2014, one of Deji's good friends that I met introduced me to the project, but he didn't introduce me to Deji. He said, there's this crazy project called Johnson that you would be dope for. I want to introduce you to the creator of the show, but we never met, but I knew about it. We finally met in 2017, me and Deji. we clicked immediately. He's one of the biggest editors in Hollywood, incredible writer, incredible director, incredible producer and actor, series regular on Bosch and Amazon. He's been on Greenleaf, he's been on Castle, all kinds of big shows. And we just clicked from the A, just great hard worker, good personality, just solid brother. And we said, hey, you know what? Let's put this show together, man. Let's shoot a pilot. So we shot one episode and we took that episode around Hollywood and we shopped it. And we took it to a lot of different places and people liked the concept, but they didn't want to bite on it because the narrative is about four Black men and our journey as brothers and our relationships with our significant others, politics, all the things that a lot of Black men talk about that we don't really hear. Because usually you see the stereotypical characters, you know, you can watch a crime show where, you know, the gangsters or we killers or hustlers, or you can watch a comedy where everything is just funny and we goofy and showing that side of us. But like, we didn't see a show that actually showed the everyday Black man that's making an honest living, that's going through certain situations in his life. And how does he navigate through those? What does it look like for a Black man to go through a divorce where usually you see he's cheated, but what if he didn't cheat? What if there's another situation, custody battle, commitment? Sometimes women think that men don't commit because they have commitment issues, but what if it's something else? What if the commitment issue is caused by something else?
Right.
We go underneath the surface of how black men are presented and represented across the board, I feel, in the media. We go underneath that and we give you reasons why we do the things we do. And I think it's important for Black men to see ourselves like this. And it's important for Black women to see us like this because I think it'll give them a better understanding of who we are. Because right now with social media, one tweet that could be totally false goes viral, then it's true.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? And we don't have those voices. Well, we have the voices, but a lot of times they're muted. Because a lot of times people don't like honesty. Honesty is scary, especially coming from a Black man.
True, true. Is this a film?
It's a TV series, 10 episode TV series that airs on Bounce TV, August 1st, 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 Central. What happened was we shot the pilot, Cedric the Entertainer, called Wind of It through one of my friends, Risha L. Archibald, who's an executive producer. She loved the idea of the show. She took it to Cedric the Entertainer and his partner, Eric Rohn at Bird the Bear Entertainment. They said they love it, immediately brought Deji and I in. Literally within a couple of weeks, we had a shopping agreement signed and we took it around town. Bounce TV loved it. They loved the concept. And they were going to allow us to make the show we wanted to make versus taking it somewhere else where they would maybe water it down or, maybe make us, just change the narrative or change some of the characters. We thought it was perfect the way it was. And Bounce, David Hudson, Keisha Cash at Bounce, they saw the vision. And we shot during the pandemic from November through February last year. At the height of a pandemic, we shot 10 episodes. D.L. Hughley is featured on the show as well. He plays my uncle. Earthquake is on the show. Angela Yee. It's a dope show. It's such an honest show from a Black male perspective that I think any Black man watching this will appreciate the fact that you might have told your wife or your girlfriend this, but she didn't believe you, but she's gonna believe you when she sees us say it. Because we reinforcing what y'all probably already said. And the Black women's voices are honest. Their perspective, it's not a biased show. It's just shown through a Black man's perspective, but it's not biased in regards to the honesty.
Right.
Everybody's flawed. Everybody has issues that they have to work through, but we're showing how that looks from our perspective.
Okay.
So anybody would be enlightened. I don't care. You don't have to be Black or Black man. Like, it could be anybody to watch this show and be enlightened by, because everybody's going to be able to relate to somebody in some way, regardless of what culture you come from.
No doubt. Give us the title and when we're going to find it again.
Yeah, the show is called Johnson. It airs August 1st on Bounce TV. If you don't have Bounce TV, you can call your local cable provider. You can download the app Bounce. You can also get an antenna because it's broadcast, so you have access to Bounce. You can get an antenna as well. Bounce is the only Black broadcast network. So they're an up and coming network. They had this show called Saints and Sinners. that that was a huge show. I think they just had that final season, fifth season this year. But Johnson is the flagship show for Bounce. Yeah, August 1st, 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central. I'm one of the lead actors. Deji LeRae, my producing partner, he's the creator of the show as well as as a writer. He's written the majority of the episodes. Philip Smithy is one of the leads. Derek's Brady. Rosa Acosta is in it as well. Has a really, really great role. Kalila is in it. Kalila actually plays my wife. And we had some very interesting conversation. Very, very interesting. And I think people watching it are going to be able to connect because it gets real. It gets a very honest show.
Right.
We keep it real on the show. It might get a little uncomfortable just because we're talking about things that are uncomfortable to talk about. But at the end of the day, you will be enlightened, and it's something different. It's something that you can leave. You can leave with something. It's not just an show for entertainment. It's very substance based. So yeah, Johnson, check it out. You can follow us on Johnson on Johnson Bounce on Instagram and Twitter.
We'll make sure to pump that joint, man. You know, as we leading up to it, make sure we getting folks plugged in. Put my platform. Hawk, his platform, his other podcast. So, you know, we gonna make sure we get folks out there for you, fam, for sure.
Thank you.
Thomas, I want to ask you a question because, you know, this upcoming series, I feel like for folks who don't know you, since, you know, I've known you for years, I feel like this is more closer to your personality. So when I see you in, especially the MMA movie when you produce, people think it's because you play football that you are a violent guy, but you're one of the guys that's not violent at all. So when I see you in a role like that, I know you tapping into something that's totally against what you are, bro. So that's why when you was promoting that movie and I looked at that movie, my wife was like, hold on, is Thomas really like that? I was like, absolutely not. And that's why I think this is the best role right here.
Thank you, man. No, but that's the thing. That's the beautiful thing about acting is that it allows you to explore every part of your being. And you know, there's certain places you have to go for certain characters that you might not there, even though you might not naturally be like that, there's a part of you that is, and that's in everybody.
Right.
Because, you know, I'm looking at it like, well, in football, you know, we're in the locker room laughing, Hawk. We laugh and we joke it. I just keep seeing your face walking by the locker room with that slick little smile on your face. Either you joking about something, you done joked somebody, or you about to joke somebody. But then when I see you on the field, it's a totally different person.
Yeah.
It's a savage. It's a competitor. It's like totally different person because that's in you.
Yeah.
It's in everybody. And the good thing about football is a version of acting. You're a totally different person in the locker room. We sitting around laughing or having lunch or whatever we're doing, you know, and versus when we getting ready to come out the tunnel. We playing Virginia Tech. We playing Florida State, you know, and you hear that chant outside in the stadium and you sitting in the locker room, you're mm-hmm. different. You become a different person. You transition mm-hmm. into this warrior, you know, and that's what acting has given me the opportunity to do on a daily basis. It's become whoever this character is mixed in with the part of the character that's me.
Right.
And that's been an escape for me because once I retired from the NFL, I didn't have that outlet.
Yeah.
I didn't have anywhere to go. And also your family structure and your friend structure starts to change when you retire. Unfortunately, the people that I cared about the most and I did the most for, some of them showed that they really didn't feel the same about me. And relationships change and communication changes. And then you either stay in that space or you evolve to the people who are where you're trying to go, or you go with the people who want to come with you. And everybody else has to stay behind. So there was a lot of adjustments I had to make. And emotionally, if I didn't have acting, I'm not sure how I would have handled those. It may have come out violently because as a football player, that's really what we do. It's a game, but it's not a game. Like you, when you crack back with the linebacker, you're not coming in there like my Jerry Sullivan, a running back's coach, receivers coach, used to always say to the receivers when they were cracking back, don't go in there with your high heels on. He's like, don't go with your high heels on. Because you can go in there and take this dude's head off. So, sometimes, man, as a football player, people don't understand that that's a part of what we do. And it's easily, you can easily take that energy from the field, mm-hmm. depending on what triggers it, and put that energy off the field. And that's how a lot of guys end up getting in trouble, because they don't know how to separate the two.
Or they don't have to hit the switch. They don't know how to hit the switch.
Yeah.
No, they don't. Yeah. They don't.
So acting is, and basically acting has been that therapeutic transition for you to fill that violent void that we had to have in order to operate at a high level for football.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. 100%. Because we're not scared of anything.
Right.
We're not scared. I mean, you're going across the middle. You're going across the middle. You know, Dex is there in practice. You know, you got that crossing right. You know, Dex is there, but you go anyway.
Yeah. You know, you're going to wake up on that bench with that smelling salt. Like, wait a minute.
You're going anyway. And you're going to catch it anyway.
Yeah. Casualty of war. Anywhere. That's a casualty of war. And you embrace that. You embrace
same. Yeah. You're right. Same thing. It's the same exact mindset. And a lot of people don't understand that, because unless you're actually in it and you feel it, you can't connect. That's why when a lot of players get in trouble outside of football, obviously you don't want that, but I understand.
Yeah.
Because you get a chance to live in your primitive space 24/7. Everybody, everybody is a Neanderthal inside. Everybody's an animal inside. It just is. You show me a woman and somebody's messing with her kid, the most meek woman will turn into a monster, because we have that animalistic instincts are in us, but everybody doesn't get a chance to experience that on a day-to-day basis and become the norm. True. So there's a lot of psychology behind it that people don't think about, but luckily for me, I was able to find acting, and it gave me a chance to really jump into this other creative space with other creators and constantly let that energy flow into characters, whether it's writing, whether it's character development, whether it's scripts, whether it's, you know, me acting, whether it's directing another actor. All of that is all encompassing, and it's been a blessing for me. So
outstanding. Fanpool, before we get you out of here, we usually end our segment with something called Shut the Hell Up, I'm Underdog. And what that is something that gets under your skin, that pisses you off, but you're like, you know what, to hell with it anyway. Normally we rock with that, but I want to give you some context this week on a topic, and it has to do with drug testing, specifically Shikari Richardson and her failing the drug test and, you know, not being able to perform in her particular event. Do you feel like, A, it's fair? And do you feel like Black athletes are tested a little bit more stringently than other athletes?
Got you. I ran track in high school. We won a state championship my sophomore year. So I understand track. Mm-hmm. Track is a little different than football. Football, you have several opportunities. If I fumble the ball, I can still end up with 150 yards and 3 touchdowns. In track, you drop the baton, you're done. You false start, you're done. You pull your hamstring, you're done.
Right.
So the room for error in track is very slim. So when it comes to drug testing, I totally understand how you want every other opponent to be clean, mm-hmm. abide by the rules, because you don't get any other chances.
Right.
So do I think that it's fair that she can't run in the Olympics? Yes, because everyone has to abide by those rules based off of what it is. Mm-hmm. It's especially in the Olympics. This is a global event. This is, and it's every 4 years.
Right.
So it's a discredit to the work you've done to not follow those rules, because it's your work down the drain.
True.
You know, true. But on the flip side, Black athletes are definitely scrutinized more. That's, you know, that I don't think that's ever going to change. I think that also Black athletes are expected to do these type of things. That's the only, that's one of the things that I hate about the situation with her, is that regardless of what her reasoning is, they don't care.
No.
And we can make, as Black people, make all the sense in the world, but at the end of the day, nobody cares.
Yeah.
That's partly because you are Black. True. And I think we have to do a better job as a culture of understanding that and not expecting them to. When you don't expect them to, then you know that the only person that's going to lose is you.
True. True. I mean, we have to be, absolutely, we have to have our own accountability measures, you know, that self-accountability. And, you know, I hear it, you know, it was a coping mechanism and all of, yeah, all of the different pieces. I get it. But, you know, at this stage, you can't afford to take that type of chance when you know the rules. It'd be different if you didn't know and you're like, oh, well, damn, I didn't know. No, everybody, yeah, has to follow by the same rules, no matter what you're, yep, going on outside of it. Everybody has to follow the same. So when it comes to that part, all right, it's even. The part that's not even to me, you know, when we're talking about athletics from a global and a holistic perspective, is the way that Black athletes are scrutinized and drug tested more than other, right, athletes. That part fucks, right, me up right there.
Right. Because it
that
does.
Part is not fair.
Right, it's not. And that's why I said we have to go into these situations expecting to things for things not to be fair.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, yep, no matter how much you think things have changed or they are changing, and maybe they are changing. The one of the things about being Black is that, you know, you're already behind the eight ball.
True.
There's all the beautiful things about being Black. There's equally negative things about being Black in the system that we're in that we didn't create.
Right.
Yep. And there's been too many examples of it not working in our favor. So to go into it, knowing you're behind the eight ball and still put yourself in a situation where your fate belongs to them, mm-hmm, the powers that be, is what I mean.
Yeah.
That's not the smartest thing to do. And yeah, I hate it for this girl. I mean, her story,
yeah,
you know, I haven't seen anything like this really since Jackie Joyner, Florence Griffin Joyner, yeah, you know,
Florence,
like,
Griffin Joyner, yeah.
The next FloJo, like, yep, swag, energy, just bringing an excitement to the sport, to yeah, just bringing the excitement, you know. Yeah. From, yep, it's like, man, like, obviously Usain Bolt and all these other, you know, incredible track stars, but when you have a Black woman like that is for the culture, she's repping the culture. And yep, her energy, it reminds you of somebody you know, and she made it to that level.
Yeah.
It's just, man, I mean, for, like, when I heard about it, like, literally that whole day, I just kept thinking, I know how hard it is to get there.
Yes.
I know how much work, yeah, she put in. I know how much work she put in. And I appreciate how she owned it.
Yes.
That's, yes, another thing. And I appreciate how she owned it and she didn't cover it up. She didn't, because that shows integrity.
Yeah.
Shows a lot, yeah, of integrity. She's young. She's 21.
21, you know, years, like, old.
It doesn't excuse you knowing the truth. But at the same time, if you haven't been an athlete at that level, major college football, NFL, NBA, you don't understand the amount of pressure that comes with that.
Right.
Like she said, I love what she said, when I'm a human just like you, I just run a little faster.
I just run a, yep, little fast.
that was the one right there. So, you know, as an athlete, the rules are the rules.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who aren't athletes, I think it's a little bit harder for them to really wrap their head around that. Mm-hmm. Because when you're an athlete, if I'm in the NFL and I'm playing against Ray Lewis and he on steroids and he knocked my, you know, helmet off, cheated, bro. Like,
right. Right.
Give me a fair shake, man. Give, right, me a fair shake, man to man, mano y mano. Let's see where we land now.
Right.
Yeah, you know,
right,
what I'm saying? And people say, you know, well, weed is not a performance enhancing drug. No, you you know, you can't say what's performance enhancing or not. It's not underperformance enhancing, but you tell me some, you tell me if some of the greatest lyrics of all time haven't come from somebody that has had a little
under the influence. Yeah.
You have, you can't tell me that some of these football players or basketball players might not be a little bit under the influence when they go out there and they relax. Now they not think about Dex in the middle in the middle of the field when they run that
great
that
point.
They not think about
point.
Dex.
Right.
The game slowed down now as a running back. It's not as fast. The game slowed down. Everything's slower. Everything's more controlled. Those jitters aren't there anymore. So that in a way is a performance enhancing. But like I said, if you haven't really been in those situations, it's a little harder for you. Now, understand, it's a little harder for you not to get. So, no, man, I think it's just a fortunate situation, but I wish her the best. I'll be following her either way, regardless, whatever she does, I'll be following her, cheering for her, rooting for her.
No doubt. And as she said, hey, I'm sorry I can't be your Olympian this year, but I'll just continue to be your world champ. I was like, just dropped the mic with it then. Well, fam, this has been awesome. Awesome. Thank you so much your time, brother. Know how busy you are. We're going to keep you lifted, man. Please keep us plugged in on everything, all the projects that are going on with you, man. And we're going to make sure to elevate them. Folks, make sure you catch Johnson August 1st on Bounce. Thomas Q. Jones going to be rocking the thing. This is this week's episode of The Lockdown featuring T-Cuff and the Ball Hawk.
Before you outro, we got to go. Sick game, Thomas. That was a sick game. That's an inside joke when he was in school.
I have not heard that since. I have not heard that since probably 1997.
I heard that George Welch is nice, though, Thomas. I heard that George Welch is nice, though.
Oh, he inspired
George
me.
George Welch.
Give it to us before we go out.
Rest in peace, Coach Welch, man. I mean, that dude right there was one of the most unique people I've ever met in my life. I mean, Welch, you know, honestly, when I heard about him passing, it just hit me different because he lived up to his word. I remember he came to my house and I had this hill where I live and he didn't know I could see him through the window when he pulled up in the rental car. And instead of him just walking around by the sidewalk, he tried to go down the hill and almost fell. And so I'm in the window. I'm like, the coach almost fell. I'm like, you know what happened? So we come in the house and, you know, he sits down. My mom had some potato chips and like a Sprite. And he just starts putting his hands all in the chips. Like, he's shuffling through the chips. You know, obviously, like, that ain't it. You know what I'm saying? But now you could have them now because, you know, it's over for them. So he's eating the chips and drinking, and he's like, you know, you can come to Virginia, we'll give you number 6 and we'll give you a chance to play behind Tiki Barber, and the next 3 years you'll have a chance to be the starter. And that's what happened, man.
How did he say it though?
We'll give you a chance. You come to Virginia, we'll give you number 6, and you'll get a chance to play behind Tiki Barber. And that's really all I can say. I don't know what else. That's what he said. I'm looking like, this man is so straightforward. Like he's laughing at you if you don't understand how honest he is. But no, man, George Welch was just like, after the game, I remember, who did we play? What was that game we played? We played somebody and we were losing. We were winning. I'm trying to remember because there were so many moments. He comes in at halftime and he goes, we were winning and we were in the locker room, like cheering each other up, cheering, like hyping each other up. He comes out of his office. He goes, shut up. Shut up.
Georgia Tech.
The game's not over yet.
You're not that good.
We actually won the game.
Yeah.
This is my senior year. We won the game. And we're all quiet because he just told us to shut up at halftime. And he comes down, he goes, where's the emotion? Where's the emotion? And we're like,
He just told us to shut up at halftime. Then he comes and he goes, where's the emotion? I mean, I don't know what's going on with you guys.
I don't know what to do with you guys.
I've never met a man like him in my life. Like my senior year, he calls me in the office and goes, do you think we can win this week? I'm like, what? You're the coach. Like, do you think we can win this week? I'm like, yeah, coach, we can win. He's like, we're pretty good. I don't know. This the head coach. He had such a way of like motivating you that was so like left field.
Right. Right.
But he got me prepared for the NFL because the mentality that the coaching staff had because of Coach Welsh, it was always team. We had the names on the back of our jerseys.
Yep.
It was team first. He didn't care how good you were, how big of a game you had. Matter of fact, the better of a player you were, the more he scrutinized you. I would catch him sometimes in practice just with his hat on, staring at me. He's always doing this, always picking at the end of his nose. Yeah. And I would just be standing there, and I'd look, and he'd just be like this, staring at me. I remember he would do the same thing with Dex. He'd do the same thing with Tiki. He'd do the same thing with Hawk. I mean, the better of a player you were, the more he kind of looked at you and just like disgust.
Yeah.
But it kept you so humble because you're like, well, the coach isn't even impressed. So, you know, but he, all the Virginia guys that I played with in the NFL that went on to the NFL, we had NFL training in college. And I think a lot of it was from his military and the Navy. And he ran a tight ship, and we all have respect for him and the way he coached and the coaching staff. So, yeah, rest in peace, Coach Welsh, man. We love you, man, and appreciate the opportunity.
No doubt, no doubt. Well, thank you, fam. We sure appreciate you, man. And we gonna let you get up out of it. We're way over time. I know you're busy as hell, and we appreciate you.
It's all good. It's all good, man. I enjoy talking to y'all. You know, I definitely love to jump back on again, maybe once Johnson comes out. And I'm here for y'all, man. I'm a big fan of the podcast, big fans of y'all. Love y'all brothers, man. Congratulations on what y'all doing. Y'all keep shining, you know what I'm saying? Giving people like me an opportunity to be heard on your platform. That's what Johnson's about too, man. It's all of us uplifting each other and showing each other love and being able to kind of give our perspective because it matters, man. So you got a fan with me, man. Definitely.
Appreciate you, fam. You keep shining.
Appreciate you.
Folks, this has been this week's edition of The Lockdown featuring T Cove and the Ball Hawk.
Christ, we had Thomas Q. Jones today.
Until next week, we are out.